Okay, this is Jeffrey Wells back doing Elsewhere Live for the first time, and I don't even want to think about how long it's been. But what began as a notion that I would do this twice weekly gradually devolved into something I'm doing one time weekly on Thursdays, which is 5 p.m. Pacific, and 8 p.m. Eastern, obviously. But it just... I couldn't swing it. It just wasn't working. It was becoming oppressive. So let's just go with it once a week. But then I had to blow it off during Sundance, and then I had to, because I tried to do it at a remote location. It became technically undoable, at least for me. And then I was at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and anyway, so here we are back in the groove. First time I've done this thing since I think late December. Anyway, so the idea, because the enthusiasm right now is, I gotta tell you, right now the enthusiasm is not with the Oscar thing. I mean, it's just like, you know, as I said in a lead piece today, that it's just, you know, it's hard to find the enthusiasm in talking about this stuff any further. I suppose there's another couple of columns, maybe another couple of Elsewhere Lives and talking about the finals, but the the thing that got me going was during a screening at the Santa Barbara Film Festival of this new documentary that hasn't been picked up, that I presume will be picked up fairly soon, and it's called Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? That was a track that I played of Nilsson's called Daybreak. That was the last chart placer that he recorded back in the somewhere close to the mid-70s. And this documentary is by a guy named John Scheinfeld, who I had the pleasure of speaking with earlier today, this morning actually. And it had its debut screening, this film, at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, not last weekend, but the weekend before last. And it's funny, but I had a kind of a mixed reaction at first, which is that I admired the film. It was obviously a very well-made film, about as thoroughly done, and didn't have any lag time or, you know. But it basically hit a chord with me because of my old man having had issues with alcoholism until he dealt with it with AA, and having tasted trouble in my own life when I was in the early 90s in that realm, so I sort of turned that one around. And Harry Nilsson's life, he had a brilliant incandescent more like 66 to 74, when he was cranking out really great songs, songs that people still listen to. Without You, which he didn't write, but he performed beautifully on his classic album Nilsson Schmilsson. Everybody's Talking at Me. Again, he did not write it, but he recorded it. It's the film that's made famous by the film. The song made famous by the film Midnight Cowboy. The Three Dog Night song that he wrote, but he didn't perform, called One. One is a Lonely Number. Daybreak, the thing I just played, Lime and the Coconut, Jump into the Fire, which was used in Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas, and then of course the one called You're Breaking My Heart, You're Tearing It Apart, So Fuck You, which I thought was, which is, I'd also like to play actually in a second, but I wanted to kind of just, the thing that got me about this film is that I admired it craft-wise, knew it was a first-rate film, didn't like sitting through the destruction of this guy's, the self-destruction that Nilsson went through. 20 years of incessant drinking and boozing and just having this kind of strangely, relentless self-destructive thing going on in his life, to the point that he died when he was only 53 years old, and that was in February of 94. And I just found it difficult to feel enthusiastic about watching this. But the odd thing is, and this is what happens with good films, is that it stayed with me. And I found myself during the Santa Barbara Film Festival telling people about it, and that it probably got to me more than any other film that I've seen there. And that usually is the measure of something that's really quite good. It stays with you, and you keep thinking about it, and you keep telling people about it, which is what I'm doing now. So this film will be getting more viewings through this and that film festival. There's a Scheinfeld was telling me earlier that the London Film Festival is going to maybe show it, and there's the Los Angeles Film Festival, which is in June. And I guess the thinking amongst a producer when you're trying to sell something to a distributor, although I think enough distributors probably did, a good number of distributors probably saw the film up in Santa Barbara, but sellers, producers, like to show films to distributors in the midst of a crowd, of an enthusiastic crowd, which is what you always get at film festivals. So that may be the case that it won't actually be acquired until sometime in the summer. But anyone who is living in Los Angeles, just keep a watch, because this film will be turning up, if not in June, perhaps even before. And it's really one of the major films of the year so far for me. I mean, obviously, the year is like 1 month old, but you know what I'm saying. It's gonna be around. It's gonna stick in people's mind. It's gonna be talked about. It's gonna be a must see for anybody that has any, you know, liking for remembrances of Harry Nilsson and his music. And it really is an exceptional thing. So let me just run this thing with John Scheinfeld. It goes on about 28-29 minutes. Then I'll run the other Nilsson song to sort of finish it off. Then I'll do a little thing about this wonderful documentary about Lyndon Johnson, which I saw 15, 16 years ago on PBS, which just came out last Tuesday, I believe it was, on a PBS home video, and I just wanted to talk about what a great thing it is. And so here comes the interview I did with Scheinfeld, and then we'll move on from there. Hi, this is Jeffrey Wells speaking.
Hey, Jeffrey.
So finally, I am up and running. We are recording. This is Elsewhere Live. And we are speaking to the to Rob Scheinfeld and his we're talking about his film Who is Harry Nilsson, and why is everybody talking about him, which I was lucky enough to see at the Santa Barbara Film Festival the weekend before last, at a kind of a celebrity-studded screening, and I think it was pretty much the first public viewing. You tell me, Rob. I've forgotten.
You know, and it's John.
John, I'm sorry, John. Bad call on my part. Excuse me, folks. I didn't mean to be. It's early in the morning. I'm sleep deprived. I woke up at 9:30. First cup of coffee. Called him the wrong first name. Great. Okay. We're really moving here.
There you go. Yes, it actually was the first public screening, and
right.
It was a real thrill for all of us who were involved with making the film to actually see it on a big screen in a reasonably full house.
Yeah. It was. As we have discussed, John, it's I can't imagine a more thorough and extremely engrossing tale of what has to be called a gifted but tragic figure. And Harry Nilsson's life is anyone who knows anything about 60s and 70s music knows Nilsson's name from the get-go. But the tragedy is that I don't know if it's. Maybe I should ask you to kind of explain the arc, but it seems to me that it was something in his mother's personality. It's about his father having left him when he was, I think, 3 years old, and never having come back. And there's something about low self-esteem that the guy couldn't stay away from being a party boy and being a bruiser. And as the Monty Python guy says at the beginning, he's a guy who loved to party, and he got that. And at the end, it got him. And yet there was those glorious 8 years from roughly 66 to 73, 74, around there, when he was really God's instrument, and it was he was one of the greatest singer, songwriter, troubadours in history.
Well, I think when you look at the life of Harry Nilsson, there's a couple of things that jump out at me. One is, I think, and we're actually, my production partner, David Leaf, and I were talking about this at the Grammys last week, is you look at a lot of these groups that have one really big hit, you know, and they're kind of the flavor of the moment, and all the magazines jump all over them, and then they kind of disappear. And I think it makes you really appreciate the value of the product of someone like a Harry, who, yes, perhaps it only was a glorious 8 years, but the music has lasted. And that, I think, is a very important thing to remember. Second thing is that we are all, I think, byproducts of our childhoods. And Harry did not have an easy one. As you say, his father abandoned him when he was 3 years old, and I don't think he ever really recovered from that psychologically. And I think it impacted on him in terms of the choices he made in life. I mean, I think all of us are very much what we are is as a result of the choices we make. And Harry didn't always make the best choices. And yet, in spite of that, you know, Jeffrey, I think the other thing, too, is that I don't know who said it, but genius is often very close to madness. And I think Harry was a genius, and I think along with that came some madness.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. I had never really listened to an audio interview with Harry Nilsson. I only knew him through his music. Those who are listening who have not had the pleasure, he's best known for Without You, which, interestingly, by the way, I always thought he had written, but the Badfinger guys wrote that.
That's right. Hammond Evans wrote that song.
And
one of the ironies of many in Harry's background,
yeah,
is as great a songwriter as he was.
Yeah.
His biggest hits came on two songs written by other people, and that's, as you say, Without You and Everybody's Talking, which is written by Fred Neil.
Right, the famous Midnight Cowboy tune, which everybody knows. Yeah. And it seems to me that, there's a great moment in Amadeus when Wolfgang Amadeus is being screamed at by his mother-in-law, and she there's something in the rhythm and the intensity and the frenzy of her yelling at him, and he hears a musical stanza in it, and he goes to the sheet and starts writing down the music. She inspires him from yelling at him. Correspondingly, Nilsson at one time was listening to a dial tone, a busy tone, and that the rhythm of the busy tone inspired him to write down the opening chord of the famous song "One Is the Loneliest Number," which he is not known for having recorded, but Three Dog Night did it in the mid '60s, and
that's
that is
where he wrote a song, and they had a monster hit with it in '69.
Yeah, 69. Oh, I'd forgotten. Okay, that is to me that is pure genius. When you just take something mundane like that, and it results in that's what genius is all about.
Very much so, and I think also genius is involved in how you view the world, and I think geniuses view the world differently. And I think that was Harry's situation as well. If you look at the kind of songs he wrote and what he chose to write about, it was very different. It wasn't sort of love songs, and it wasn't, you know, drug songs, and it wasn't even, you know, let's go down to Mexico and have a great time songs. He wrote about very complex, unusual subjects. It could be about railroads, could be about dogs, it could be about his own life, as in the case of one of his really wonderful songs, 1941, which is very much his own story.
You know, it's interesting, your film made me want to see the disastrously bad Dracula vampire film that he made with Ringo Starr, right? Maybe you can help me on that, because there's a wonderful tune that I happen to provide a link to in my column called Daybreak.
Yeah.
And I love that song. I mean, that is beautifully arranged. It's got a wonderful, you know, kick to it. I could listen to that song all day long, but it was one of the shittiest films made in the history of motion pictures.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's a great song. In fact, it was actually Harry's last charting single.
Okay.
But, the movie was made in 1973. It was, at the time, called Son of Dracula.
Okay.
Ringo was the producer, and also the co-star with Harry. And it kind of was like just one big home movie. But actually, they got somebody to put up the money for it. And
Were they to shoot in 16, you mean, or?
No, they shot in 35.
Okay.
It's just, you know, there was some kind of a script, and there was some kind of a director, and there was some kind of a story, but it all was kind of loosey-goosey, and
it sounds like you're saying woozy-boozy.
Very possibly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it didn't really cut together well. And
right.
They premiered a version of it in the spring of 74 in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why Atlanta, but they did.
Right.
And they kind of got slammed, and
they
never really put it into theaters, and they recut it over the next 12 months, and they added some narration by Harry's character. But the narration was written by Graham Chapman of Monty Python. And that didn't help either. And that version they ended up calling Son of Drac.
Okay.
And that's the title card actually we use in our film. But it's really fascinating to see Ringo and Harry together. It's fascinating to see a movie where Harry actually performs a couple of his songs, because, as you know, Jeffrey, he never performed live.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting tidbit about this movie that we did not put in our film, because there wasn't any room for it, and it was kind of off story. But Ringo, as the producer, hired Harry to be the actor in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed that instead of a traditional salary, what Harry really wanted were new teeth.
Huh.
So Ringo sent him to the dentist, and he got new teeth.
Okay.
And so there you go.
The film, another song that I've had a big thing for over the last roughly 15 years is a cut from Goodfellas. That Harry, that everybody knows instantly. If they know Goodfellas, they know this song. It's called "Jump Into the Fire," and it's used to animate the scene with Ray Liotta's character, sort of coked up and running around Long Island and New York in a kind of a paranoid frenzy because he thinks he's being watched by narcs and helicopters over above. And it's a perfect complement to that kind of thing. And it's again a brilliantly orchestrated song. You say in the beginning, or someone says for you in the beginning, that there's a genius melodic element in his songs. Every one of them had a hook. You know, you just had to listen. I don't know even when this song "Jumping in the Fire" was recorded or wrote, but I think it's as good as anything else he's done. I love that song. That song.
Yeah, well, it was on the Nilsson Schmilsson album in 71, and
right.
Actually. Someone you wouldn't think is playing piano actually is playing piano, and that's Jimmy Webb.
Wow, okay.
That track. Now, Harry in some ways wrote very cinematically, and a lot of his songs are very appropriate for movies, and that's why they keep popping up every so often.
Yeah.
If you saw, or any of your listeners or readers saw "You've Got Mail," they used the four Harry songs in that film. It really suits well. And last year, "Coconut" was used in a big Coca-Cola commercial.
All right.
And actually, even in our film, what I wanted was to only use Harry music. We didn't want to hire some composer to compose the underscore for the film. So. What we did, as you know, you were sitting there when I told the story that night, but with the full blessing and cooperation of Sony BMG, who's Harry's records company, I went to New York and we remixed 28 Harry tracks, recorded between 67 and 77, and we stripped the vocals off, leaving only the music that was underneath.
Okay.
And that became the underscore to our film.
Wow.
What... Because Harry's such a great singer, and because he overdubbed himself so well, I always found myself kind of very carried away by the vocal line, and I didn't really fully appreciate how impeccably produced and orchestrated and arranged the music underneath really was.
Right.
And it really gave us almost every kind of mood, every kind of a feeling that we, whether it was humor, drama, poignancy, tragedy, we got all of that in Harry's music, which really helped us to tell his story.
Yeah. The I'm a huge fan. I love that anecdote of as they were standing by Harry's grave, all these rock music legends. He died in 1994, for those who haven't got the details memorized. And I think it was George Harrison who said, sort of impromptu as they were standing there, that his favorite Nilsson song or lyric was, "You're breaking my heart, you're tearing it apart, so fuck you."
Right.
Which I don't remember that it was played in your song for very, in your film for very, very long. Am I wrong? I remember hearing a stanza, but that was about it. Do you have a much of a, did I miss that?
It's in there. There's some film footage of Harry and some of the musicians doing a music video to that song.
Right, okay.
And so we've got it in there, and we're also discussing the song at the same. It's probably in there for a minute and some.
Yeah,
so it's in there. And Richard Perry, the producer, talked quite a bit about how that song was very indicative of where Harry was mentally at the time and psychologically at the time. It's a great tune, great lyrics, and by using the F word, he really made it basically unplayable for all but underground FM radio stations.
Well, what I think is so good about that song is that it's obviously the emotion of someone who's coming from a really fairly immature place. It always takes two to break up a relationship. So,
yes.
So fuck you, you've hurt me. All I want to do is have a good time with my friends. I mean, it's clearly... the less illuminated way of looking at the breakup of a relationship, but it's honestly that, and that's why it's cool. That's why it's funny.
Very much. Well, Harry had a very unique sense of humor,
right.
And that I think is very clear in that song. Yeah, very much so.
I haven't even gotten into the difficulty. You said. Perhaps you can just recount how long it took you to do this. Obviously, all documentaries are, to some extent, labors of love, but I'm sure that you must have gotten a lot of assistance from all of Harry's admirers, which are legion. Some of them turned up at the screening 2 weekends ago. Brian Wilson was there, and Mickey Dolenz, who is a friend from O&M. Can you just tell me about who you got help from and how long it took you?
Sure. We were working on the film on and off for about a year and a half.
Okay.
We tried to sell it to a network for several years before that. And
what network?
You name it. I mean, we tried Bravo, we tried PBS, we tried A&E.
I mean, you tried for a pre-sale to get money to work to finish it. Is that what you mean, or you mean it was?
No, we actually wanted them to commission it, so we would have money right from the start.
Got it.
Everyone expressed interest, but it was not quite enough to get them to commission. It was like, well, we'd love to see it when it's done. Okay, fine.
What, they didn't trust you, or they don't think Nilsson's big enough, or what?
I think they just weren't quite sure that this was, you know, a big-ticket item for them. Because Harry is one of those artists that he's very well known in the music business.
Yeah.
But because he died young, and because his recording career kind of fizzled a bit in the late 70s, he's not as well known as he ought to be.
I got to tell you, my 17-year-old son, who's a connoisseur of he's become a connoisseur of 70s music, and he just bought Rubber Soul. He told me about a week ago, and he liked his getting more and more into the melody of that time. He didn't know Harry at all.
Right. No, a lot of people do. I mean, they know some of the hits, you know, that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we would put it away for a while, then we take it out, try to sell it again. Anyway, finally, the attorney that represents the Nilsson estate was able to raise independent financing to get us to the festival cut that you saw.
Okay.
And so none of us took any money, but we put it all on the screen. And it was really a labor of love, and with the gamble that we'll get a distributor and we'll all, you know, get our fees at some point. But what really surprised us, I think, as we went through this process, was how well loved Harry really was, both for what he was and what he wasn't.
Yeah.
And Do It For Harry kind of became a mantra for people, and we were given photographs, we were given film clips, we were given so much stuff by people, and they didn't charge us for it. So, yeah, fine. For Harry, great. It's about time somebody was doing something like that, and we got so much stuff to work with,
right.
And which is great for us, because as you can imagine, it's really difficult to produce a documentary about a guy that rarely appeared in public and never did a concert.
That was my feeling as I was watching it in the beginning. I was thinking, yeah, for a guy who was as famous, at least in my head, and I know people that know anything about 60s and 70s music, I was surprised that there was relatively little footage of him at all until he did Playboy After Dark appearance, and around that time, what was that, about 66 or 7 or something? Or
68, yeah, and he did a bunch of TV shows in the kind of the 68, 69
right.
time period, and then really never again except for two BBC TV specials.
Yeah.
For example, as huge monster a hit as Without You was, there's not any film or tape of Harry performing that song.
Wow.
So we kind of had to create something for the film.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the nice comments that we got from the people that saw it in Santa Barbara was they were totally drawn into the story, totally engaged, and only at the end would they start to sort of say, well, you know, what about this, what about that, or where did that footage come from, where did that come from? They were so sort of drawn into the telling of the story,
mm-hmm.
and that's a great compliment for all of us.
Yeah. The thing that was initially staying with me, and that's, to be, as I told you, and I'll just be honest with the audience, if anyone's had any kind of history with any kind of alcohol problems, as I had briefly in the mid-90s up until 96, and I had I have an issue with my dad, who was an alcoholic until he got into the program, he's still an alcoholic, but he started... He went into the program in the mid 70s, and I've just seen it, you know. And I think a lot of people. Well, it's you know, obviously there are tens of millions of people who've had alcoholism affected. It was so dispiriting to consider the specter of a guy who was so imbued with such a gift to you know, like piss his talent away for such a sustained time. And it struck me that didn't anybody? I mean, all these guys who were supposed to be friends of his, and they love him, obviously, they say they do, but did anybody ever, like, say, look, this is obviously, I mean, he's lost his voice, because we haven't mentioned in this broadcast, but Harry, I guess, oversang, or it was the exuberance of recording Pussycats, he blew out his vocal cords. Maybe you could explain what that was. That when it happened, when they were recording
Yeah, it was Pussycats? During the Pussycats.
Yeah.
That's quite a dramatic story. Harry just kind of being self-destructive, but
yeah.
You know, I think, Jeffrey, it's a hard thing to answer whether they were enablers around him or people that said, hey, Harry, you know, you really should stop.
Yeah.
You know, rock and roll, the rock and roll world is prone to craziness anyway, and it's possible all the people around him were just as crazy as he was, or perhaps not quite as crazy, but
yeah.
They may have all been kind of on that same ride, you know, and they were all doing it to one degree or another.
Mm.
It's possible some of his friends did. We know later in life they did. But in the 70s, when he was, you know, the guy, it's hard to say, really.
Mm.
But also, as you know, with people, sometimes they really have to want to stop. If they're very stubborn and it's like, oh, you know, you can't really tell them what to do. And I think Harry was definitely one of those personalities that you could not tell him what to do.
Mm.
No one could. He was very much his own man.
You know, I was about to say earlier, I didn't get the thought out, but there's a... and for one of the first pieces of film in which you show him in an interview situation, and it struck me that he was a very intellectually assertive fellow. He was very, very smart, and you could feel the intellectual aggression and focus and precision in the way he was expressing a thought verbally. And it just... you know, I hadn't really gotten that from him. You know, you don't know what some songwriters are like, sort of idiot savants. They're not that they don't cut that much of a presence in conversation. When they get behind the mic and start singing, there's something else. But he was really quite the he was quite a verbally impressive fellow in terms of his vocabulary and his manner. You know,
Harry was a very, very smart guy.
Yeah.
Before he got in the music business, he was in the banking business.
Mm.
And he, for 7 years, he ran the computer center at the branch of the Bank of America here in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles.
Right.
And supervised 100 and some people. So this is not a dumb guy.
Yeah.
There's a Mickey Dolenz told me that there was a trick Harry used to do where he would go up to somebody and say, all right, so what's your birthday? And, you know, they would say November 12th, 1966.
Yeah.
And he would say, that was a Thursday, without, you know, even hesitating. And it was right. And he was always right. Some mathematics, thing that mm-hmm. enabled him to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what the birth date was, no matter what the year was, he could tell you what day of the week it was.
That sounds like a Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man, Idiot Savant thing.
Yeah, you know, very much so. and you see it in the word, the rhyme schemes and the
yeah.
words that he uses in his songs. These are not sort of, you know, Moon in June kind of lyrics, you
yeah.
know, that are so simple. These are somewhat complex lyrics.
Right.
When he was at the top of his game,
mm-hmm.
and very smart guy, and
yeah.
and that really is part of the, again, one of the ironies of Harry is really smart guy and some really dumb choices.
Yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
but isn't that kind of the
mm-hmm.
the history of mankind? You
right.
know?
And let me compliment you while we're talking about the film is that you've got your company, which is called LSL Productions.
That's right.
Has a really great-looking site for the Harry Nilsson film. The Nilsson film begins with a kind of a stroby effect of each letter popping through in fast sequence. You know, who's Harry Nilsson and what everybody's talking about him. And this black and white motif in the site is really quite brilliant. I don't know who you got to design it, but I really love it. I think
it's cool. No, it was actually designed by May, who
uh-huh.
works in our office.
Okay.
And Who is Harry Nilsson is actually the main title of the film, which was designed by our editor, Peter Lynch.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And neither of whom knew who the heck Harry was when we started.
Yeah.
And now they, you know, hum his music all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing. Well, you know, I was going to comment on something that you had written right after the Santa Barbara screening. And I think it's one of the great things about movies
yeah.
is how they can impact on us.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, well, this is a very interesting review because Jeffrey clearly liked the filmmaking, but there were some real negative things about Harry, and it was because you were viewing him through the prism of your own life.
Right.
And that's
exactly.
one of the cool things about movies in general, is that
yeah.
we all do that, and we all kind of look at that. But I think what I would probably say what makes a great movie, not that ours is or isn't, but is that if it stays with you, and if
yeah.
you remember it, and if it impacts on you, and I have always found that about Harry's music, for example, that it stays with you, it impacts on you.
And your movie stays with you. That's the interesting thing. I mean, it didn't leave me alone. And usually, there's the films that get you right away as you're watching it, and then they kind of fade into the night sky when you go out. And the next day, you know, they're not that with you. And this one's definitely stuck, and I want to see it another three or four times at least. I mean,
and that's
you know.
Great. That's great for us to hear. And,
yeah.
and in a way, how you felt about Harry the Man, I suppose, is if we made you feel that way, then we've done our job.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you know, the I got my specialty is writing and typing out everything exactly correctly. I got a slight issue here. I've noticed that the question mark at the end of your title is here and there inside the closing parenthesis, and it should be outside.
Is this in the movie? Or
look at it closely on the site anyway. No, I'm not saying in the movie, and I'm presuming, because you do have it correctly on the very top of the site, but the question, who is Harry Nilsson, is obviously a question, and why is everybody talking about it? But so it's correct to have the why is everybody talking about him in parentheses, but the question mark should definitely be the final thing, because it applies to both statements, both questions.
Yeah, very so. Much so. I have to go look at that.
Look at it very closely here and there. You see that, I think it might be the press notes when you get right down to it, but I'm seeing it here at the lower left.
I'll have to take a look, but your listeners should go check it out anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The website is
yeah.
www.whoisharrynilsson.com.
Oh, that's how to get to the film, because I'm looking at this thing, it's LSL Productions.
You can get to it from our website, the LSL
I got it.
Productions website, or you can get to it straight by...
All right, let's repeat that. Whoisharrynilsson.com. And as you have told me, you guys do not yet have a distributor, but I can't imagine this not being distributed and someone not stepping up pretty quickly.
But we sure hope so. We've had a number of expressions of interest, and...
Yeah.
They're all, you know, DVDs have gone out, and some
yeah.
of them actually were in Santa Barbara, and so we're kind of waiting to hear As you know, in show business, nothing moves quickly, and
yeah.
This is a good example. But we're very confident, and the Santa Barbara thing was a great boost to all of our spirits because we'd worked so hard on it, and to have people respond the way they did was great. And so now we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Now, as you have said, and I don't want to pin you down, but I'm for those listening in the L.A. area, anybody who might happen to be in the industry, there is. We're hoping that there's going to be some kind of industry screening within the next few weeks or sometime not too long in Los Angeles.
Yes, we hope so. We were actually talking about that the other day.
Yeah.
What may mitigate that a little bit is we're having some conversations with the Los Angeles Film Festival about being there, and they may not want a local screening and before we get there. But we'll know in the next couple of weeks what our situation is. We're also talking about some other very big film festivals as well. We've been approached by London and a couple of others. That there's a nice buzz starting about the film, which is really great. And this is, it kind of manifests itself in requests. Oh, we'd love to have this in our festival. And so now we're kind of looking at which ones would make the most sense for us.
Now, what is the L.A. festival that we could be talking about? There's one in the late summer. Is it the AFI Film Fest? And then there's...
Actually, it's called the Los Angeles Film Festival. It's in June.
Oh, okay.
Very big film festival, particularly well-attended by industry people.
Right.
And,
Yeah.
We're talking about some other ones as well.
Right. All right, well, if you have something, I was very keen to see it, so I can't wait to see it again. That's all I can say.
Get it, Jeffrey, and I really appreciate the interest, and I'm delighted that it is still staying with you, and hopefully it will continue to do so, and thanks for helping to spread the word.
Thank you very much, John. I really appreciate your time, and I just hope to see it in theaters very soon, and I can't wait for the DVD. I'll bet there will be all kinds of stuff that you're going to throw on that.
All kinds of extras. We've got more stuff than we know what to do with, so it's going to be really cool.
So that's going to be a big plus. So. All right, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Be well.
Bye.
Okay. Well, really good song. I've listened to that song for about 18 times since I was at the Santa Barbara Film Festival and saw the Nilsson thing. Anyway, I hope everybody gets a chance to see this film later this year, probably late summer, fall. Certainly this year, I hope. I wanted to mention in closing, because I am not on this program of, having to do an hour, so I'm just going to end it when I feel like ending it. Basically, there's a DVD that came out either last Tuesday or the week Tuesday before, but I think it's last Tuesday. And all it is a four-hour documentary that was originally aired on the American Experience on PBS in, I believe, around 1990, around there, maybe 91. Actually, no, I just found out it's 91. 235 minutes. It's one of the most brilliant, sweeping, emotionally affecting, and I mean that not just from a point of view of someone who, was younger in the 70s and remember that time period, but it's one of the most emotionally affecting and historically perceptive, plain-spoken documentaries I've ever seen. And it's basically just called LBJ, about the story, the tragic story of Lyndon Baines Johnson, his life in as a Texas representative, House of Representatives, then as a senator, then as majority leader, his ascension to the presidency on November 22nd, 1963, when Kennedy was killed, the glorious first 2 years of his presidency, and the swift downfall that happened when the Vietnam War overtook his presidency, all his far-reaching liberal social programs, many of which are with us still today, that the Bush people haven't undone. And it was just one of the best times for what government was, what it could do for this country, for people in this country. And it's just one of the most tragic stories, not just because of the 58,000 American guys who bought it in Vietnam, but the many, many, many more Vietnamese who were killed during that horrible chapter. And it's not to say that you come away from this thing feeling that Johnson did the right thing. And if the Doc has a failing, it's that you don't, it doesn't quite look at the refusal of people in his administration, including Robert McNamara, to see beyond the immediate political pressures of the day and take the view that they had to stand up against what they saw as the threat of world communism, geopolitically coordinated world communism, as opposed to what was actually going on in Vietnam at the time, which was essentially nationalists versus the corrupt South Vietnamese in the pocket of the Americans. Basically, a civil war. It was horrific what happened. Horrific. And yet you come away with a feeling of not just a sense of tragedy about Johnson, but you come away with a great feeling of affection for him. I feel this affection because of the way his personality, the way he was, his largeness of spirit as well as body, reminds me of my grandfather, my father's father, who's from Kentucky and was sort of like Lyndon Johnson. But anyway, I've taped, and I have an excerpt from the very beginning of the show that kind of lays it out. And then there's a wonderful moment at the very end in which a historian whose name is Ronnie something, and I'm not able to remember for some reason his last name, but he's a Johnson authority, the guy who's written and researched him for many years. He sort of finishes up the bit. So here's clip one. It'll be followed right away by clip two. Here we go.
He had been scorned as an unscrupulous politician, a vulgar wheeler-dealer, driven by ambition and a lust for power. But on January 20th, 1965, the night of his inaugural gala, Lyndon Johnson was a happy man. Overwhelmingly elected, he promised to wipe out poverty and segregation, protect the old, and educate the young. That was his dream. Few presidents would ever know more triumph. Few suffer such a swift and tragic fall.
And he was selfish. He was kind. At other times, he was cruel. At times, he was an earthy, crude, acting fellow. At other times, he was incredibly charming. He could be whatever he wanted to be. He was a strange, a complex man who had basically almost a Jekyll and Hyde existence. He was two different people.
What was it that would send him into those fantastic rages where he could be one of the nastiest, most insufferable, sadistic SOBs that ever lived? And a few minutes later, really be a big, magnificent, inspiring leader.
What you have is a man who is a thoroughly American president, who is American from day one of his birth in South Central Texas. This is a man who reflected American moods and attitudes and contradictions and trends. And when he failed, it was America's failure.
Hubris, as the Greeks would put it. And when the gods would destroy, they first make man. Now, this is a man who was so big that reached so far and made it, and then let the whole thing crumble. I think it's one of the great stories of history.
He was just interesting as hell. I mean, you know, compared to most people who kind of go through life mainly making their dreadful moral points or condemning this or hoping for that or scratching the back of their head. Lyndon really moved. He was moving all the time. The few times I was with him, he was just fun to be around. And you liked him. You liked him. I liked him when I was with him more than I did when I was thinking about him.
LBJ, the director, is a guy named David Grubin, G-R-U-B-I-N, PBS Home Video, and it is in your video store, and I guarantee you, this is a DVD, a documentary, a story worth committing 4 hours of your life to. I don't know how else to say it. It really, really is. And you come away from this thing feeling much wiser and sadder and yet larger somehow for what it was, what it is, what the documentary is. Very good piece of filmmaking. Narrated by David McCullough, who has done other pieces like this. It's interesting that they don't include on this particular DVD that just came out McCullough's introduction to the show. And yet, way back when it was on Laserdisc, I mean, this is not new to the world. It's been around in different forms. But way back when, the Laserdisc had the McCullough intro. And it was kind of a nice, warm, kind of, you know, folksy introduction. And it was an agreeable way to watch it. It's funny that they cut it out. Probably some rights issue. Anyway, all right, so we're at the about the 50-minute mark. So, all right, I'm going to close this off. Got some Brokeback Mountain music that I've thrown together. And I'll be back on next Thursday, and I may, as per custom, throw together a sound file from time to time and just put it up on the archive, which I'm slowly learning to do myself. Okay, this is it. Be well.